Welcome to EdUp Legal. I'm Patty Roberts, and I'm here from St. Mary's University School of Law, now speaking with Michael Waterstone, who was appointed the 18th Dean and Senior Vice President at Loyola Marymount Law School in Los Angeles on June 1st, 2016. Welcome, Dean Waterstone.
Thank you, Dean Roberts. I appreciate you having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you. And first, I want to talk to you a little bit about your path to the deanship. I know that you were already tenured there in 2006, or you had taught there from 2006. You did some administrative positions, associate dean for research and academic centers. And then you decided to throw your hat in the ring to be a dean. Why did you choose to do that?
Glutton for punishment, I guess. I think there were a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I loved then and I love now our school. I was definitely not looking to be a dean anywhere. Loyola is a place that's deeply meaningful to me. My father's a graduate of our evening program.
And oh, that's really cool.
He was super excited when I got the position. But it definitely is a school that resonates a lot with my values. And I felt like it was something that I was excited for a new opportunity. I felt as ready as any of us could feel, which is turns out not at all ready to step into that role. But I truly enjoyed being a practicing lawyer. I love being a classroom teacher. I felt it was a real gift to be able to do research and work on that set of issues. What I missed most about being a practicing attorney was the sense of having a team and working with a group of talented colleagues toward a common goal. And as a classroom teacher, you can replicate that somewhat, but it's a different relationship. So I had enjoyed the administrative work I did, and I was excited for the opportunity to be a part of a team and really feel like we were moving an enterprise in a common direction.
So you mentioned that the values really resonate with you from Loyola Marymount. Can you tell us what those values are? How do you define the mission and the values of your institution?
Yeah, I always say I think there are three things that distinguish us. The first is I really do believe we are the best at preparing our students to be lawyers. And that sounds like an audacious thing for a law school dean to say, and it probably is, but we are a school that has always had commitments in experiential education, the commitment to teaching, the commitment to meaningful outcomes around things like bar pass and job placement rates, and the extent to which our faculty truly delight in teaching and welcome students, not just into their classrooms, but into their lives, has always felt like something that was a good fit for me. And I think that was something that has always really resonated. The second thing was, I do believe we have been and remain ahead of the curve. Los Angeles is one of, I believe, the most exciting cities in the world. It is large, sprawling, diverse, and we have really attempted to stay ahead in terms of what we teach, who we teach, and how we teach. What we teach, whether it's a concentration, the first concentration west of the Mississippi in cyber, whether it's a first-year elective in innovation law. We've really tried to prepare our students not just for the world that they're entering, but where things are going. In terms of who we teach, for a long time, like a lot of our schools, we taught JD students, and really realizing that a great law school is about teaching more than JD students. I think law is more important to the world than it's ever been, but that means it's too important to be left to just lawyers. So creating training opportunities for executives, creating programs for foreign trained attorneys, for master students, really revamping what it means, who we teach, and finally, how we teach. And we can spend more time on this, but we had started looking into remote instruction before the pandemic. So really just staying ahead of the curve. And the third thing that spoke to me then and speaks to me now is our commitment to social justice, which is drawn from our mission. It is real, it's genuine, it permeates everything we do from the moment students arrive for orientation. And I'm incredibly proud that we, I believe, passed the first formal learning outcome of any law school around law and systemic inequality, saying that a part of a Loyola education, a formal learning outcome, is learning about systemic inequality. Our clinics are a visible manifestation of our commitment to social justice. Doesn't mean we all agree on what it means. We never do, but certainly in the Jesuit tradition, it's the process of working towards something and learning and reflection and discernment rather than an actual destination. So long answer to a short question, but those are all things that spoke to me then and continue to make me not just excited, but on my good days, joyous about this position.
No, I love listening to you talk about these things because you really light up. I mean, the energy and the passion that you feel about them is evident in talking with you. I can see your face, but I'm sure that everyone can hear you on our podcast and your enthusiasm. So let's talk a little bit about that commitment to social justice. We share the joy of leading an institution that is committed to social justice. And I'd love to know more about how Loyola Marymount is addressing social justice within its curriculum and perhaps beyond it.
Sure. And I think, you know, for both of our institutions, it's important to remember social justice is not new to us. It's part of kind of what we've been doing in our case for over 100 years. And as now the second or third Jewish dean of a Jesuit law school, it's certainly been an exercise in humility, but also learning from friends and colleagues about the Catholic and Jesuit conception of social justice and the deep tradition there. For us, I think it occurs in everything we do. When we talk about access to justice and realize in so many ways, we have and have had always a broken legal system. In many ways, our legal system is the envy of the rest of the world. And I've been privileged to travel all over the world, particularly on issues of disability rights, and seen how different states and countries look up to us and aspire to aspects of our legal system. But it doesn't change the fact that so many communities in our country do not have meaningful access to justice. And as a law school with deep commitments in that area, we're always looking to bridge that gap ourselves, but also train the next generation of lawyer leaders who will go out and seek justice for those that would not otherwise have it. So I mentioned our commitment to law and systemic inequality as evidenced by our recent learning outcome. That was something that the faculty voted on, and we are just really proud of that. Certainly a visible manifestation of our commitment to social justice is our Loyola Social Justice Law Clinic, which houses our in-person clinics around areas of immigrant justice, our Center for Juvenile Law and Policy, our Project for the Innocent, all of which are seeking to fill that access to justice gap that exists in our community. And as we chatted about before, I was fortunate enough to do 2 years of clinic in law school, and it was the way I most directly learned about law and inequality and how people who don't have access to justice will never get a fair shake in the system. And to be a part of a school with such commitments in that area that gives students the opportunity to work on those life-changing cases while they're still in law school is incredibly meaningful.
Now, do you have a clinic requirement, or students just opt in because that's the nature of the student you also attract, is those who are committed to social justice?
More the latter. We were, I believe, the first law school west of the Mississippi to create a pro bono requirement for our students to graduate. And it was the students themselves that created that, not the faculty or any part of the university community. So I do think it is somewhat self-selecting. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is there are lots of different ways to serve the community and do pro bono work and to do social justice work. It doesn't need to be in the criminal space. There, you know, whether it's advising startups or in business law, there are all kinds of opportunities for this kind of work.
I'm intrigued by your learning outcome about systemic inequality. We also have a pro bono requirement. I love that we do, and I know you're very happy that you do, and students enjoy and learn a lot from that experience. But what does it look like in order to for a student to meet that learning outcome?
Yeah, and I think all of us in legal education are a little bit new to the learning outcomes game. This is something that we, you know, my first decade in teaching was not as pronounced in the way that some of our colleagues in our other schools and colleges have been perhaps more invested in this for some period of time. So we now have learning outcomes listed for the institution, and every syllabi has learning outcomes listed. So the conversation we really had as a faculty and as a community is, if we were to create this learning outcome, how we could be intentional about making sure that most, if not every course, had the opportunity to learn about this, what this would look like in different types of courses. We created training opportunities for ourselves, and we'll continue to do so. But certainly the fact that it was something that we moved on, it so quickly and so comprehensively, meant that it was really important, not just to our faculty, but to our student community also.
That's really great. Thank you for sharing that. So tell me a little bit more about your clinics. I mean, you are the most centrally located law school in downtown Los Angeles. You're located across town from the university, the broader university. And I imagine that puts you right in the middle of the people most in need in a city as diverse and large as Los Angeles. So can you share with us a little bit about the impact of those clinics in the community you're located in that you serve?
Yeah, and it's been such a journey. I mean, we went from having several individual clinics to housing them under the umbrella of the Loyola Social Justice Law Clinic. We now have a physical space on campus that really looks and feels more like a public interest law firm with staff and paralegals, and we always want to create more opportunities for support, but we've really had to change the nature of how we think about ourselves as a community, because we have clients coming in even during the pandemic because they have legal needs that need to be met, and they don't exist on the academic calendar, as you know. So we have a team of dedicated clinicians. Some are research tenure track faculty members, some are clinical faculty members, some are staff attorneys, and there are different classroom components as well as field work. But we do, as you suggest, really leverage that location in Los Angeles. We also, for many of our clinics, have community partners. So our immigrant justice clinic works with a mission in town. They used to work with Homeboy Industries, and they still do. And so it is, you know, the community right around us. I see no evidence that things are becoming more equal as opposed to less equal. So there's definitely a role for us to play and to continue playing. And I'll say, from my vantage point, the beauty of teaching a student in their formative years through real life learning and working on an actual case, you can see the way it just sets their brain on fire. And there's a magic to being a part of that while you're still a student. And I always urge our students, take the opportunity while you're in law school to help someone with your legal training. Don't wait until you graduate. There are plenty of opportunities to do it, many in our own backyard. And it changes you. One of my most meaningful experiences as dean has been, or many of them have been related to the clinics. One that comes to mind are Loyola Project for the Innocent. They had a client named Andrew Wilson who had served 32 years in jail for a crime he did not commit. Oh, he got released. An hour later, he's on our campus wearing a Loyola t-shirt, surrounded by his team of student attorneys. And, you know, I got to meet him. He shook my hand. He thanked me. And all I could think of is, thank everyone around you. I did less than anybody here. But just seeing not just the look on his face, but the look on the student and staff attorneys and professors' faces, knowing that they had worked together toward that result, was just incredibly meaningful in a moment I'll never forget.
That's wonderful. I'm afraid that the internet cut out for a second when you were saying just an hour after, was it his release that you got to have that?
Yeah, it was an hour after he was released. He came to our campus wearing a Loyola t-shirt surrounded by his team of students.
Oh my gosh.
It was a beautiful moment.
That's fantastic. Very memorable. And those students will never forget that and the impact they've had on someone's life. And what I always loved with clinic work is that it inspires them long after they leave. So, you know, when I was doing veterans benefits work in a clinic, we'd have students that would go off and tell their senior partners when they were brand new associates, we should be doing, you know, pro bono work for veterans. And then they'd start programs, and it's a true ripple effect across the profession. You mentioned your evening program, and I know that you have some innovations in that program that I'd love for you to talk about.
Thank you. So yes, we have been doing part-time legal education for over 100 years. We started as an evening program in 1920. Our class of, it was seven men and one woman. So we've been doing this for a while. As I mentioned before, I believe my father is a graduate of our evening program, so this is very personal to me. And we've always, from the beginning, taken great pride in the fact that our evening students are our students. It's not a two-track system. You graduate from Loyola Law School with a JD. And indeed, our evening students, many of our most successful and dedicated alumni. And my father could not have come to law school but for the evening program. He was working as a teacher and a speech therapist during the day, and it was his only opportunity. And but for Loyola having that and being that gateway school, nothing I would have gotten to do in my life would have ever happened. Our evening program decades ago used to be, you know, over 100 students. And it was, the last decade or so has been more challenging. And there are a number of factors. One is perhaps the biggest one, traffic. It used to be that people could come from all over town, but for your listeners who are not in Los Angeles, to get to Los Angeles four nights a week at 5 o'clock, if you don't already live and work in downtown Los Angeles to our campus, has become fairly impossible. Just to give you a point of comparison, I live in Santa Monica. If I want to get to the law school campus downtown by 6, boy, I better leave by like 3:45 to be sure I'm going to make it. I mean, traffic has become a real problem. So that's a barrier. Another challenge is people generally having jobs that end at 5 o'clock such that they could get to 6 o'clock anywhere. The nature of work has changed. It used to be that employers would pay for a student's legal education, aerospace, a lot of areas, and some still do, but it's become less of an employee benefit. So our program did face all of these barriers and has been stable enrollment-wise, kind of in the 40 to 50. And it's not so much that we're looking to grow that number, but more we wanted to do what we felt we had always done right, which was make part-time legal education accessible to a broader range of people and to true either working professionals or parents or people whose life circumstances prevent them from enrolling in a day program. So we thought about this carefully as a community, extensive faculty involvement, and decided to leverage a lot of the lessons we learned from the pandemic and create a program where someone could get through 4 years of law school, essentially only needing to be on campus one night a week. Now we combine that with a little bit at the front of the semester and a little bit at the end of the semester, more of a boot camp format. Put that together, we were forced to go to the American Bar Association for a variance, which we just found out last week that we were successful in. So
congratulations.
Thank you. It was fun. So we are looking forward to enrolling our first cohort of students who know they can get through law school only needing to be on our campus essentially one night a week with some additional bookend time at the end of the semester. Now, that's a prescribed schedule for the first 2 years. After that, they can really enroll in whatever they want. But if they want that path through law school with experiential offerings, with everything else, we are going to create a track for them to get through 4 years only one night a week. So we are very excited. This is going to create the flexibility that today's learners want. but also open up a JD to a broad, a Loyola JD to a broader range of people in Southern California and beyond that otherwise would not have access to it.
Well, that's really terrific. We have been going through a similar process, and we'll be enrolling our first 25-person online part-time cohort this fall. And we're very excited about it. Similarly, trying to expand access to a legal education. I mean, we can't diversify the profession if we don't diversify legal education. And I think the kinds of innovations that you're talking about with part-time education can certainly help do that. So I was intrigued, of course, to learn that your dad was a graduate of the program at the law school you now are dean for. I can't even imagine the proud dad moments that brings. But you also said he was a teacher and a speech therapist. And so I'm wondering, how much did that contribute to your specialty in disability law scholarship and advocacy?
Yeah, I wish I had a better story about that relationship. I don't. I went to law school thinking I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer and did my third year paper on the Casey Martin case. Casey Martin was a golfer with a very significant leg disability who sued the PGA Tour for the ability to use a golf cart in tournament play. And case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. He eventually won. I wrote my third year paper on that and kind of came at it just from a sports fan perspective. I thought it was an interesting sports issue and left with a real appreciation for disability law and thought, wow, this is a relatively new area. At least the Americans with Disabilities Act was at the time passed fairly recently. A lot seemed up for grabs. It certainly seemed interesting and important. I have and had family members with significant disabilities. Most of us do. And it just was something that I really wanted to learn more about and spend more time with. Then I went and clerked, and my judge let me work on some ADA cases as part of that clerkship year. And then I started at my law firm. And one, I was fortunate enough to work at a law firm that really valued and supported my pro bono work and started doing pro bono work in disability rights cases. And also had the good fortune of having a partner who became a mentor and dear personal friend, Charles Siegel, who was prominent in the disability rights community himself as a lawyer with a disability. And he opened some doors. And then I started working on cases and got asked to write in a case book. And it was the type of thing where it was never a particularly well thought out plan, but one thing led to another. And I feel really just incredibly grateful because I've had some amazing opportunities and experiences and been privileged to do work that I think is both phenomenally interesting, but also I believe is important.
It's absolutely important. I mentioned working with veterans with disabilities, but also did special education. And I think our paths crossed when we were both doing special education related legal work. But it's really so phenomenally important. And I know one of the things that you focused on, like in your testimony before the Senate on issues related to voters with disabilities and older voters, is those with disabilities taking part, having an equal part in our election system. And so, you know, we hear a lot about election reform now. It's in the news all the time. And where would you say we are in that journey to making sure that there's equal access to voting for those of us who suffer from disabilities?
Yeah, I feel like it's marginally better than when I started, but it's always a struggle. I think that, I mean, I remember I started off writing on voting and disability, and it felt the law of democracy or election law or certainly election administration at the time felt like more of a niche area, kind of a boutique-y thing. Now, it, you know, every law school is offering law of democracy, election law. It's become an important part of how we all think about our role, not just as lawyers, but as citizens. And it's something that is more important and pronounced. And I think doesn't just wax and wane in every election cycle, but is now a kind of profoundly front burner important issue. And people with disabilities have always had a unique role to play in that debate. And I think in many ways, in many contexts, were the canaries in the coal mine for a lot of challenges that existed within the voting framework. And I remember having to explain to people that when you go to vote in an election, it's less regulated, certainly at the national level, than you might think, that so much of this is run by state officials, county officials, party officials, and it is this uneven, but in many ways, glorious patchwork of machinery and ideas that lead to our democratic process. So I think certainly the disability community has remained engaged in this issue. And it's there are laws that have been on the books that have helped. I mean, so you take a law like the Help America Vote Act, wonderful law, very little in the way of enforcement. And certainly with disability, the gap between law on the books and enforcement of law has always been a concerning and large one. It's been interesting trying to, as someone with a background and interest in disability law, holding this position both at Loyola, but also in legal education, there are, like in any sector, disability rights and disability accommodation issues that the academy and legal education is grappling with, and trying to offer myself as a resource and convener on some of those topics. And we're very lucky here. When I started right around that time, we received a major gift from Tony Coelho, who was one of the architects of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and is not a lawyer, but is an LMU alum from Loyola Marymount University. And through his philanthropy, we were able to create the Tony Coelho Center on Disability Law and Innovation here at Loyola. And it's given us a really rich toolbox to examine, to learn. And one of the things we've done that I'm most proud of is we've created a cohort, we call them the Coelho Fellows, who are talented undergrad students with an interest in law school, and give them programming, mentorship, coaching over the course of a year, and really prepare them on that path. So as you know, there are so many amazing pipeline programs, and our law school, just like yours law school, has a lot of them and supports a lot of them, but there hadn't really been one dedicated to disability, and too often disability didn't exist within existing pipeline programs. So
right. We
were really pleased to be able to start this, and we hope it is a model that can be widely replicated.
That's terrific. Well, good for you. I will keep my eyes open and look to you when we want to embark on some of those initiatives here. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about baseball. Clearly you are a baseball fan. I see bobbleheads, and do I see Little League photos behind you?
Yes, I have three kids, a 16-year-old daughter, a 13-year-old son, and an 8-year-old son. And my daughter plays softball, my sons play baseball. And one of the things I do to keep me, you know, sane and excited to this position is usually most afternoons, you know, cut out for a couple hours to go watch, coach, participate in their sports in some way. And we do love baseball. I was very excited that they managed to set aside their differences and get together on a season. So it's something that we're—
Yes, coming up now.
Yeah.
Well, that's terrific. April 8th, I think, is that when they're starting?
Opening day, yeah.
Opening day.
And spring training is starting actually a week from— or no, it's starting this Friday. So it's happening. Okay. It's exciting.
That is exciting. Well, before we conclude, I want to ask you what I ask all our guests, and that is, what are your predictions for the evolution of legal education in the coming decade? Not only what do you think is likely to happen, but if it's different, what should happen in the coming decade?
Yeah, well, there's a great legal philosopher you probably know. His name is Yogi Berra. And he once said, predicting the future is hard because it hasn't happened yet. Uh-huh. So with that caveat, so what do I think will happen and what do I want to happen? Certainly we're all going to— well, first of all, I think legal education in many ways, although we set the table, we also help serve the legal profession. And the right. legal profession has always changed and it will continue to change. So when you talk to folks in the world, you know, they're grappling with the future of the workplace. They're grappling with remote modalities. They're grappling with long overdue conversations and reckonings around social justice, of which racial justice is a crucial pillar. They're grappling with the role of the rule of law to help a democratic system thrive. Over the next decade, I think all those are going to continue. And if history teaches us anything, at even a faster pace than they have, which will continue to drive innovation at the law school level. And I think that, you know, you and I have been both been doing this long enough to see there have been some incredible innovations within legal education. And I think they will and should keep developing.
Yes.
So I think we're going to see more programs experimenting with different form of modalities. My hope is that we see institutions making progress on creating student populations that better serve the communities that we live in, and better reflect the community that we live in. At the same time, you know, we're all facing the same pressures, which are rising costs of tuition that there's no easy answer for. We are, you know, facing, although we're several years behind our undergrad colleagues in terms of the demographic cliff that's coming, where there are simply going to be less students in the pipeline. And maybe we'll get a larger share of the existing, but the overall pie is going to be decreasing just because the birth rate went down. So that's something we're obviously always watching. But in terms of the fundamentals, I think the rule of law and the role of a lawyer is more important to the world than it's ever been. And I see that continuing over the next decade. So I think they will continue to be a role for all of us to play in creating those lawyer citizens to go forth and ideally make the world a better place and have the tools to support themselves and their families.
Well, I agree with you. And I think that some of the work that you're doing in who you're teaching and who many of us are teaching to develop some legal expertise in addition to just the traditional JD students will help us to continue to evolve the profession. And I'm glad law schools are jumping on board with that instead of resisting it. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining me and good luck with this baseball season.
Thank you so much for doing this. I'm really grateful. It's a lot of fun. Thank you, Dean Roberts.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.